Greetings, everybody. Welcome to Galactic Roundtable. This is Beth back with you again. I'm so happy to have you here. We're having a special broadcast tonight. Thank you, Don. Thank you, Doug. And it's because I would like to make a presentation that takes a little bit longer than usual. We are coming upon a very important time. Last year, April 29th to May 3rd, we had the citizens' hearing on disclosure in Washington, D.C., and former Congress members and House of Representative members, retired, came to listen to the testimony. And on the first day, second day, on the third day, the congressman stopped asking, where is the proof? Because the witnesses were yelling back at them, it's classified, and that's the problem. So now Stephen Bassett, who is the executive director at Paradigm Research Group, who was the executive director of the Citizens Hearing on Disclosure, is going back to Washington, D.C. And now they have presented to the United Nations the need for to end the truth embargo and have disclosure. And they're organizing to meet at the UN to discuss this in the General Assembly. And Steve is going back to Washington, D.C. in his role as a lobbyist. He's the only registered lobbyist in Washington, D.C. working on the extraterrestrial issue. He's going back to Washington, and he's going to ask Congress for official congressional hearings. So we have to ask ourselves, well, why do we need to do this? First of all, I would like to take a very candid point of view, and this information is coming directly from the King of Swords. 535 members of Congress and only 65 are above board, non-criminals, not taking bribes, not bought and sold. The other thing we have to understand is that the arrests have been ongoing since early 2009, and many of Congress have been taken out and are being held as their trials have been taking place at The Hague. And in their place has been put solid holograms and a few clones. When we have congressional hearings, we are challenging the ones sitting in the seats listening. Some of them are responsible for holding the truth embargo in place. And that's how we get closure on the big arrests. This next step to disclose disclosure couldn't be more important. What I'd like to do for you tonight is to lay out the story of how we got here. Many of you will be asking for your friends and family to understand the disclosure, why disclosure is so important, what it means to us. And so I want to take you back through the history tonight. And so I'm not going to talk for a long time because it's going to burn up our chance to study this. I want to go back to the fact that President Kennedy had decided that he wanted to join forces with Nikita Khrushchev, and he wanted to share the UFO files between countries, and he was going to disclose and make public all that was going on. And the ones running Area 51 and the CIA did not want that to happen. And that was Majestic 12. So we're going to start with Majestic 12 and what happened with President Kennedy, because only then can we understand what happened with Bill Clinton. And I will have you listen to Grant Cameron's take on the Rockefeller Initiative. Grant Cameron is a UFO researcher since a very long time, many decades, and he is the cousin to David Cameron, the past Prime Minister of the UK. He has connections, and he has quite an interesting website about the presidential involvement in the UFO story throughout, all the recent presidents. He has some access and some good information. I'd like to talk next about Bill Clinton and his role as the disclosure president and how that came and went, and what's coming up with President Obama. So thank you, BBS, for this extended show. And I want to start this out with Dr. Michael Sala. He has a website called exopolitics.org. I consider him an expert in the field, and he has excellent information. He had kind of been a little bit quiet for a couple years, and now he's coming out with exposés that are mind-shattering in recent months. And rooting him on his work is phenomenal. So this is a Veritas presentation, and it is Dr. Michael Sala being interviewed, and he's going to tell us what happened with President Kennedy and the disclosure movement. Here we go. Enjoy this. It's fabulous.
The very word secrecy is repugnant in a free and open society. And we are, as a people, inherently and historically opposed to secret societies, to secret oaths, and to secret proceedings. Differences worldwide would vanish if we were facing an alien threat from outside this world.
We must guard against the military-industrial complex.
You want answers? I think I'm entitled.
You want answers?
I want the truth!
You can't handle the truth!
The questions you always had, the answers you were never given. The place to seek the truth. Welcome to Veritas.
Headline edition, July 8, 1947. The Army Air Force has announced that a flying disc has been found and is now in the possession of the Army.
I'm as mad as hell, and I'm not going to take this anymore!
The power they took from the people will return to the people.
The Matrix is everywhere. It is all around us. It is the world that has been pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth.
Shall I tell you what I find beautiful about you? You are at your very best when things are worse.
Sooner or later, though, you always have to wake up.
Be skeptical, but don't close your mind.
Greetings to everyone around the world, and a warm welcome to another edition of Veritas at VeritasRadio.com. I'm your host, Mel Fabregas, and I sincerely thank you for joining me once again. And if this is your first time, please make yourself at home. A big thank you to all our members for making our truth journey a reality. To listen to part two of tonight's interview and all of our material, just go to VeritasRadio.com and click on the subscribe button. You will receive your login immediately. And have you listened to Sanitas Radio yet? If you haven't, you're missing out. You cannot put a price on health, and Sanitas is doing for health what Veritas does for truth. Check it out. Go to sanitasradio.com. And with the seasons changing, this would be a good time to purchase MMS. You never know when you'll need it, and it's better to have it and not need it than need it and not have it. Go to the Veritas store for more information. And to get in touch with us for member support, media inquiries, you want to be a guest or are a whistleblower, there's a link for you by clicking on the contact button of our website at veritasradio.com. And tonight's special guest is Dr. Michael Sala, an internationally recognized scholar in international politics, conflict resolution, and U.S. foreign policy. Michael has a PhD in government from the University of Queensland, Australia. During his academic career, he was author and editor of 4 books focusing on international politics. Dr. Sala is a pioneer in the development of exopolitics, the study of the main actors, institutions, and political processes associated with extraterrestrial life. He is the founder of the Exopolitics Institute and the Exopolitics Journal. And to learn more about Dr. Michael Sala and his work, and purchase his new book titled Kennedy's Last Stand, UFOs, MJ-12, and JFK's Assassination, visit his website at exopolitics.org. And directly from Captain Cook, Hawaii, I would like to welcome Dr. Michael Sala back to Veritas. Hello, Michael, and welcome back. How are you?
I'm well, Mel. Thanks for having me back. I'm looking forward to this interview.
It's my pleasure, and I finally read the book last night. Thank you for sending it, Michael. And I had my suspicions about what Kennedy had seen before, but I never, for some reason, never put Kennedy and James Forrestal together as a link, as a prodigy that Kennedy was. But first of all, so that the audience knows, what motivated you to put all of this together in a new book?
Well, like many people, I've always been fascinated by the Kennedy assassination. For me, I was only 5 years old when it actually happened. And it was really remarkable because my father came into the yard where I was playing and he told me that this American president had been killed and he began crying. So I'd never seen my father cry before. But, you know, it was kind of pretty memorable. I kind of felt like something really important had happened. There was something about this man, Kennedy, that made my father cry. And I was only 5 at the time. So obviously, you know, I was oblivious to it all and, you know, not having any kind of political knowledge at all at the time. But it kind of stuck with me. So I've always been fascinated by President Kennedy and his assassination. And over the years, as I've begun to do more research into this field of exopolitics, there have always been these kind of really interesting references to Kennedy, and that Kennedy may have been kind of trying to find out what was happening on this issue of UFOs. And so I began to dig and wrote a few articles about finding out what had happened in the latter portions of his presidential career. And then I kind of stumbled across that Kennedy actually in 1945 had made a trip to post-war Germany as a guest of James Forrestal, and that was really kind of opening the door to many insights and connections here, because Forrestal was at the thick of things. So I was really kind of shocked when I realized that James Forrestal was actually John F. Kennedy's mentor back in 1945, and that Forrestal had really kind of opened the door to Kennedy learning a lot of things, and that Kennedy himself actually had a history in naval intelligence. So there's a lot of kind of historical connections here, which really importantly are backed up by fact. That this is not speculation. There's documents showing that, in fact, these events did happen, that Kennedy was involved at a very high level with some of the meetings that were deciding the fate of post-war Germany and the future of the planet. And Kennedy was right there and being told about it all.
And most people obviously know who John F. Kennedy was, but a lot of people may not know who James V. Forrestal was. For those who may not know, who was James Forrestal and why was he so important to this story?
Well, James Forrestal basically began life as a journalist. Then he became an investment banker and became very successful. Along the way, he met Joseph Kennedy, who was the father of John F. Kennedy. And both Joseph Kennedy and James Forrestal were both Irish Catholics, and they had a very similar history. They were both made men, and they were opposed to the kind of establishment, and the establishment tended to be kind of white Anglo-Saxon Protestants, and so being Irish Catholics, they were really kind of against the establishment, and Joseph Kennedy and James Forrestal both became involved in Wall Street reforms. So after the great crash, the Great Depression in 1930, when that all began, the Wall Street crash, 29-30. So James Forrestal was involved in Wall Street reform, and along the way he met Joseph Kennedy. And so they became friends. Joseph Kennedy would eventually rise to become the ambassador to for the United States to Britain. James Forrestal's career an interesting turn because he left Wall Street banking to become the Undersecretary of the Navy under the administration of Franklin Delano Roosevelt. So Roosevelt was advised that James Forrestal was the person that would help the Navy prepare for this enormous war effort that was just around the corner.
Did he have any military background, Forrestal, before this?
Yes, he served as a junior lieutenant in the First World War with the Navy, but he didn't rise to any prominent position. His expertise was really in banking and basically being able to help reform kind of outdated financial structures, because that's where he made a name for himself, in being able to implement reforms of Wall Street. And so, that's where he met Joseph Kennedy, was the very first chairman of the Securities Exchange Commission. So that's a very interesting historical connection between the two of them. But anyway, so Forrestal was nominated to basically help with this reform of the Navy so that it could prepare for this enormous war effort that lay ahead. So he was appointed to the to this position of Undersecretary of the Navy under Roosevelt, and then rose to become the Secretary of the Navy in 1943, just as the war effort was taking off. And so Forrestal was at this very senior position in the Navy when, of course, many interesting things were happening around the world. And he was in the loop of some of the major decisions that were being undertaken. And it's just kind of historically, it's nice to point out that at this time, you had the LA air raid of 1942 in February. Where, of course, it's well known that there was a fleet of ships or aircraft that were unknown, and that there was a big artillery barrage launched against these unknown aircraft. Apparently, according to one of the documents released through the Majestic files, documents by George Marshall, who was Secretary of the War to President Roosevelt, and from Roosevelt to Marshall and vice versa, basically they acknowledged that there had been a crash of one of these vehicles, and the Navy had gained possession of this crashed UFO, and that it was basically extraterrestrial in technology. They referred to it as an interplanetary vehicle, and that the Navy had it, and that they were passing on the information to the Army's Counterintelligence Corps for further study. And that's when you actually had the formation of the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit, which is in itself a very important historical development. But it's important to point out that at the time of those events, Forrestal was the Undersecretary of the Navy, and only a few months later rose to become the Secretary of the Navy. So Forrestal was certainly briefed about what happened, that the Navy had captured a UFO of interplanetary origins, and that a top intelligence team was created by the Army to study this craft to find out whether it could be used for the war effort.
How do we determine that it was indeed an extraterrestrial vehicle and not perhaps a Nazi technology?
Well, at the time, this had happened just after the declaration of the war in the Pacific. So there's no way that the Nazis could have had technologies operational in the Pacific theater at the time. I mean, obviously the Nazis were using V1 and V2 rockets against Britain. That was really the extent of their being able to launch sort of any kind of aerial attack. They were very proficient in submarine warfare, and some of the German U-boats. They were producing a phenomenal number of U-boats. The Germans were producing one U-boat a day.
Yeah,
incredible. But nothing in terms of any aerial capacity off the coast of California at the time. And of course, we have the documents that the Majestic people have been able to provide these memos from George Marshall to Roosevelt and vice versa, talking about these technologies as not being earthly in origin, that they were otherworldly in origin, and that they were interplanetary. And that was why the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit was created at that time, soon after the LA riot, air raids in 42.
There's so many reasons why JFK may have been assassinated that I could actually discuss it for an entire day. But some researchers say that it could have been because of his demands to access files and images concerning an ET presence on Earth. You think this is plausible?
I think it's very, very possible. I think Kennedy experienced during the Second World War and what he had been told by Forrestal afterwards made him very familiar with this level of information. And, you know, I mentioned the LA air raid. Well, what's interesting is that at that very time of the air raid, John F. Kennedy was with Naval Intelligence. And so he was actually responsible for helping send relay world events information through the various naval channels so that he could get to the right person. So John F. Kennedy was working in Naval Intelligence at the very time Naval Intelligence had retrieved a crashed UFO of interplanetary origin. Then, of course, later on in 1945, he becomes a guest of James Forrestal in a post-war tour of Germany, and actually gets to see at first hand many of the captured Nazi superweapons, which many people have come forward to confirm were far ahead of anything possessed by the US or Russia, and in fact were extraterrestrial in technology, and we can talk about that a little bit later. And then later on, when Kennedy became a congressman, he was being briefed in very select meetings by a number of kind of up-and-coming congressmen with very senior officials in the Truman administration, including Forrestal, about what was happening behind the scenes. And then you finally, you have the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit report basically talking about the Roswell crash, and basically it's referring to Kennedy receiving a briefing. So all of these kind of historical documents all point to Kennedy being briefed about UFOs as being interplanetary in origin. So now it kind of makes a lot of sense as to why, when Kennedy became president, he would want to know about the UFO issue. He'd want to know, well, you know, what's been happening over the last decade or so. What is the latest kind of technologies that have been developed? What's the future? You know, what role does the president have? I mean, all of these things are things that Kennedy would very much have been interested in. So I think it makes a lot of sense to understand that we really can't begin to understand why Kennedy was assassinated if we don't look at his historical knowledge and associations with key figures involved in the extraterrestrial program, and why it is that when he began his presidential term, he would have been naturally inquiring about what was going on with these extraterrestrial projects and trying to gain access to this. And this is where it gets, this is where we get the kind of foundations for what happened in November 63.
So you think that Kennedy actually learned about the ET presence during his time with Naval Intelligence then?
I think during his time with Naval Intelligence, he first learned about the ET phenomenon. As I mentioned, he was there when the air raid happened and the UFOs were recovered by the Navy. Linda Moulton Howe interviewed two whistleblowers, she calls them reliable sources, who basically independently said that it was when Kennedy was in Naval Intelligence that he first learned of the extraterrestrial presence. So, and that period was in 42. Then later on, Kennedy went on to become a PT captain, and of course, you know, everyone knows the history of him, you know, his ship being torn in two and him becoming a war hero, saving some of his subordinates. But it really dated to that period in 42. And then, of course, we have what Kennedy was exposed to when he was became a guest of James Forrestal in 45 in the post-war tour of Germany. And it's important to mention that Forrestal wanted to recruit Kennedy to his personal staff. So this wasn't just Forrestal, you know, including Kennedy in his kind of press corps. It was Forrestal wanting to recruit Kennedy and basically wanting to give Kennedy exposure to what life would be if he was part of the personal staff of James Forrestal. And of
course, he was being groomed.
Exactly. He was being groomed. And Kennedy had to make a choice. He had to choose whether he would enter the political arena, become a congressman, or become part of the personal staff of Forrestal. And of course, Joseph Kennedy, John F. Kennedy's father, played an important role, because when John F. Kennedy's brother died, Joe Kennedy Jr., when he died in an air raid incident during the Second World War, then Joseph Kennedy Sr. wanted John Kennedy to enter Congress, to go into politics. But if John F. Kennedy's father, brother, hadn't died, it's likely that Kennedy would have joined the personal staff of James Forrestal, and his life would have been very different.
Certainly. And JFK, he became a congressman, what was it, January 3rd, 1947. So by July 1947, he was in Congress. And that's when Roswell happened. Do you think that he was briefed about the Roswell incident being a congressman?
I think he was. Basically, we do know that Forrestal was briefing a lot of congressmen, up-and-coming congressmen, senior congressmen, about sensitive national security information. So we know that that's an actual historical fact, that that was happening. There are records proving that. And that Kennedy was identified, along with, interestingly enough, Lyndon Johnson, as two up-and-coming congressmen who could basically be exposed to the most sensitive national security secrets in the United States. So this is historical fact, which, you know, was surprising when I came across it, but it's definitely something that can be shown to be accurate. So Kennedy was already being briefed about very sensitive national security information. And, you know, we go back to that 1942 incident off the coast of Los Angeles when that UFO was recovered. We go to the Nazi Germany and the retrieved technologies that had been brought back to the United States under Project Paperclip. And also, it's important to mention Operation High Jump in 1946-1947 with Admiral Byrd, when he launched that expedition, was in charge of that expedition to Antarctica, where they encountered a UFO force that basically was protecting the Nazis who had relocated into that area. So this was all happening when Forrestal was Secretary of the Navy. So Forrestal was a friend of John F. Kennedy's father. He had tried to recruit John F. Kennedy to his own personal staff and had taken Kennedy on a trip to Germany and had briefed him. And so there's a lot of historical facts there that basically give us a lot of confidence that Kennedy was briefed about all the national security information prior to and when he joined Congress. But the clincher for me was the Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit report, which basically says that Kennedy did receive a briefing about Roswell. It's in there. It's in that particular report that Kennedy received a briefing from a senior Air Force from the Air Force Secretary, that Kennedy had been cleared to receive this. And if you look at that Interplanetary Phenomenon Unit report, it just stated it as a matter of fact. It didn't say, well, this was a kind of security breach, that, you know, something had to be done to kind of ensure Kennedy's silence. It was just, oh, yes, by the way, John F. Kennedy, a congressman, has been briefed about the Roswell crash.
And, of course, Forrestal took Kennedy during his visit to post-war Germany, and that's at the time when Operation Paperclip was taking shape. What do you think Kennedy found out about Operation Paperclip and what happened later?
Well, it's historical records that Kennedy traveled as part of Forrestal's entourage to visit very secretive technological laboratories and facilities that had been captured from Nazi Germany. So, for example, in his book, Prelude to Leadership, that's John F. Kennedy's book that very few people know about, and I certainly didn't realize how important this book was, but this book, Prelude to Leadership, it actually describes Kennedy's trip in 1945 to post-war Germany as a guest of Forrestal, and it describes, you know, what he saw, what he encountered. And you kind of get a sense of what was happening because he describes visiting these Nazi facilities. He described visiting facilities for the construction of the E-boats, which were kind of like the Nazi equivalents of the PT boats, but kind of twice the size and more powerful. And also visiting the advanced submarine facilities that the Germans had in Bremen. Where, as you mentioned earlier, they were building one submarine a day. It was just incredible. They had built over 1,000 submarines during the entire war effort. So Kennedy was visiting these, and he writes about them in Prelude to Leadership. So those are the things that he could talk about. You know, obviously, there are other things that he saw that he couldn't talk about that were classified. And what's very interesting was that Kennedy was a guest of Forrestal at the Potsdam meeting. Now, the Potsdam meeting happened in July of 1945 in Germany, just near Berlin. And that was when the big three, that was President Truman, Prime Minister Churchill, and Soviet Premier, the Soviet leader, it'll come back, but they were Stalin. I don't know why I couldn't remember that. Joseph Stalin. Stalin was there, right. So Stalin, Churchill and Truman were there at the Potsdam meeting, and they were deciding the fate of post-war Europe. They were deciding what to do with the rest of the world. Of course, at the time, the war in Japan was still going on, and that was when Truman first informed Stalin and Churchill that they had this new weapon called the atomic bomb and that they were going to drop it on Japan. So that gives you a kind of an idea of the magnitude of that meeting. But the other thing was that this was the time when Truman gave the go-ahead for Operation Paperclip. His final decision to authorize Operation Paperclip came in when he returned to Washington, D.C. in August of 1945. So that meant that when Truman traveled to Germany in July of 1945, he saw the Nazi technologies. He was briefed about how these technologies are important for the United States in the future by his top military advisors, including, of course, General Eisenhower. And so then he made the decision to authorize Project Paperclip. Well, at this very time when Truman is there touring Germany, having access to these senior leaders and discussing the future, what to do with these German technologies, what to do with these German scientists, Forrestal was there. He was the Secretary of the Navy. He was actually part of these discussions. And Kennedy was a guest. Kennedy was Forrestal's guest. And obviously, as a potential staffer for Forrestal, Kennedy was being briefed about all of this information. So Kennedy learned firsthand about Project Paperclip. And he was listening or a participant or observer to these very high-level meetings that were happening involving Eisenhower, Truman, Forrestal, and other important leaders.
Well, Kennedy also had his expertise on PT boats, so he was able to look at the German technology and comment on the differences between both. And it seemed that the weaponry was the same, but the German boats were probably double the weight and more sophisticated in many ways. But about Truman, was he really that motivated to start Operation Paperclip? Because did he ever ask why the victorious Allied powers would need the scientific expertise of the defeated Nazis?
Yes, exactly. I think that would have been an obvious question. Why would the victor in a war need the technologies of the vanquished? Why in the world would you need that? Well, we've had various sources, official sources as well, have basically confirmed that Nazi Germany had achieved a superiority in a number of critical areas in aeronautics and rocketry and so forth, and that made their expertise and the technologies that they had developed indispensable to the United States in the future. And that Forrestal was actually one of the people that was very strongly anti-Soviet, anti-communist, and he really wanted the United States to take the Soviet threat seriously. Truman, I think, was kind of a little more trusting of Stalin and of Soviet communism. Churchill, we know, was very distrustful, and he agreed with Forrestal that that the Soviets couldn't be trusted. So Forrestal was part of this entourage or this group that thought that it was really important that the United States could get the best and brightest of what the Nazis had achieved in terms of their scientific expertise and repatriated all to the United States. There are various documents that support this. There's a former CIA agent, Virgil Armstrong, that talked about some of the Nazi technologies actually being extraterrestrial in extraterrestrial in nature, that they were kind of very similar to the UFOs that were being sighted. Also, Edward Ruppelt, the very first head of the Project Blue Book, he also referred to the Nazi technologies as being the closest that could match the kind of performance of UFOs. So definitely Truman was persuaded by the military people around him that what the Nazis had developed during the Second World War was really indispensable for the future and really necessary to oppose what the Soviets were planning. And I think ultimately Truman decided that he would go ahead with Project Paperclip, which definitely was a pretty difficult issue to approve, given what had happened during the war. And so they began to kind of repatriate all of the technologies and all of the scientists that they thought would help in these kind of advanced technological projects. And of course, we know about the repatriation of the V-1, V-2 rockets that they brought hundreds of them over to the United States, as well as the rocket engineers like von Braun and so forth. But what we don't know are the more classified technologies they brought over, like UFOs that they took over to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base for further study.
I always wondered, this is kind of a side note or side question, between Truman and Stalin, how did they determine which engineers, which scientists they would, take each country?
I think that they basically just relied on the recommendations of their military advisors and their scientific advisors, and they just kind of like tried to guess what would be the kind of technologies that they would need for the future. Both of them realized that during the war that they had been kind of unlikely allies. But now that the war was over, Nazi Germany had been defeated, that I think Stalin recognized, certainly Stalin did. I don't know if Truman kind of recognized that early, but certainly he would have been aware of the possibility that the United States and the USSR were fated to be antagonists. And so they would really look at what could possibly be retrieved from Nazi Germany that would help in the future confrontation. And of course, both the Americans and the Soviets at the time had nothing like the V-1, V-2 rockets that Nazi Germany had developed. That Nazi Germany had also developed the first jet fighters, like the Messerschmitt. These were technologies that neither of the major powers had. So, how they won the war, in a sense, as these technologies were coming online, kind of shows you the kind of historical poor judgments that were made by Hitler and his people. But certainly, the Nazi technologies were far superior to what was possessed by the Allies. So they were the obvious targets for what Stalin and Truman would want to repatriate to their respective countries.
And this is when the story becomes very interesting, at least to me, when Truman appoints Forrestal as the very first U.S. Secretary of Defense. You would think that somebody with the qualifications he had would stay for a long time, but he lasted for less than 2 years and 2 months before he died is when allegedly he resigned. But you think that Truman actually fired him, don't you think?
Oh, yes. I think when we look at the events leading up to his firing, It's very clear that that there was a policy dispute, that there was some major policy dispute that led to a falling out between Truman and Forrestal. And I think it's really important to point out here that, that Forrestal was a minority. He was an Irish Catholic in a national security environment that was dominated by kind of people from the Protestant community, if you like, or people who kind of came up through the ranks of the establishment, the kind of New England establishment figures. These were the people that were kind of in the majority. So Forrestal was a minority, and he was famed for actually being very kind of rude to people of authority. He was very efficient. He was very attentive to details and a really good organizer, which is why he became Secretary of the Navy and why he was chosen to be the first Secretary of Defense, which obviously was a monumental job in organizing to merge the different military services that previously had been very separate, to merge these into a unified command. And so this was why he was chosen for that job, that he was a really very bright, very astute man who had really great organizational skills, very insightful. He knew all the secrets. He had been kind of briefed on everything that had happened. So he was the kind of natural choice to be the Secretary of Defense. He was the best man for the job. But he kind of came from a kind of very different tradition to many of the others in the national security establishment, being Irish Catholic and being kind of opposed to the kind of Protestant establishment, if you like. And he was very much an egalitarian. In today, even back then, people saw him being kind of more socialist. He was an egalitarian. He believed in basically helping people. And he was, as I mentioned, he could be very rude to people of important positions, but he was known to be very kind with people in the working class. So this was a man who was very different to the people around him. But nevertheless, he rose to become the very first Secretary of Defense that was created in September of 1947, the Department of Defense, that unified the Department of War and the Department of Navy and then created the military services as we know now, the Navy, the Army, the Air Force and the Marines. Those were all created under Forrestal's leadership. He was in charge of that. So, of course, as the Secretary of Defense, he was responsible for ensuring that everything to do with these services was done in a way that they could be funded for their various projects. And, of course, we know about Operation Paperclip, that the Army had basically taken a lot of the German scientists to White Sands missile base, missile range, to basically develop the new generation of advanced rockets, that the Air Force had taken some scientists or had certainly taken some of the technologies to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. The Navy had their own facilities for the study of these advanced aeronautical projects. So Forrestal was in charge of all of that. And he was a man that was certainly up to speed on all of the secrets that the various services had and the UFO secrets. And I think that what happened was that eventually he disagreed with the secrecy policy. And we know that there was a secrecy policy that was implemented. This was something that eventually later was written about extensively by Major Donald Kehoe in his books. His most famous book, or the one that I think is most important, was in 1945, where he talked about the flying saucer conspiracy. So in that book, Kehoe basically mentioned the silence group, the group of senior military officials that believed in secrecy. And he said that they were opposed by the openness group or whatever term he chose, that basically mentioned that there was another faction in the military, in the Air Force, that wanted to release this information to the people. And Forrestal belonged to that group, but he was in a minority, especially back in 1949, when all of this was new still, very, very new. Forrestal was in a minority. And we know from historical records that he was regularly giving briefings to senior congressmen and up-and-coming congressmen, including John F. Kennedy, about various projects that were being run under the Department of Defense. So I think it's very plausible that what happened, and certainly this is something that Forrestal describes himself in his diaries, that towards the end of his kind of term as Secretary of Defense, he began to be followed by very shadowy people. And so now we would recognize those as being the kind of mysterious men in black. But at the time, of course, people were kind of wondering what was going on, what was happening with Forrestal. I think what was going on was that Majestic 12, the first Majestic 12 group that had been set up, that was something that had decided on a policy of secrecy, and that essentially Forrestal disagreed with that. And as he basically went on his own path, because he was very much a maverick in many ways, he really could buck the establishment. So as a maverick, he basically was telling people that he felt had a right to know about this issue, and that was basically congressmen. And he was telling these people, and there are other people in the Majestic 12 group that basically were wondering what was he doing. You know, if the majority decision was to maintain secrecy, why is he going around briefing people? And so I think that ultimately led to action being taken against Forrestal to discredit him to begin with. And so he began being followed, he began being harassed, phones being tapped and that sort of thing. And eventually, this kind of gave Truman the means to be able to sack Forrestal as someone who was kind of like, you know, quote, losing it. That, the newspaper reports were basically referring to Forrestal kind of suffering something like a nervous breakdown because all these people were following. But I think that was how Majestic 12 basically thought that they could eliminate Forrestal, first to discredit him, by basically leaking to the press that Forrestal was imagining being followed and so forth. You know, Forrestal was getting the Secret Service to check on phone lines that he thought were tapped, but the Secret Service would say that they weren't tapped. So that kind of thing was going on. And eventually Truman, in March of 1949, sacked Forrestal. And then, of course, there was 2 months of where Forrestal was basically committed to a medical facility. And, I can talk about that, but...
I'm glad we're talking about this because this is definitely pivotal, because I'm looking now at some of the players here. Let's just start with 1947. You know, we have Roswell and then Truman. All of a sudden, the creation of MJ-12, Majestic 12, happens. And we have to look at some of the people who were involved here. One of them that I keep looking at is Alan Dulles. For some reason, I keep looking at Alan Dulles as a culprit on this, and then we can fast forward later and talk about the Kennedy assassination. But he was, you know, at one point, he wanted to organize a plot to kill Hitler, and that didn't happen. So obviously, he had ways of organizing assassinations. Then he was involved with the OSS, which is the predecessor of the CIA, and then he became the CIA director. So I wonder if Dulles was the one who started the proverbial ball rolling to get rid of Forrestal. What do you think?
Well, Dulles was someone that was very much involved in the predecessor of the CIA, as you mentioned, under Wild Bill Donovan, who was the general who basically set up the OSS. Dulles was in the covert operations of that organization. So then afterwards, with the predecessor to the CIA, the counterintelligence group, Dulles was also working in that capacity in covert operations. So he was definitely a person who was very familiar with covert operations. And if MJ-12 wanted to basically discredit and eliminate Forrestal, Dulles would have been the person that would have been one of the keys to that process, and so we do know that that the CIA was very intimately involved with the running of UFO projects or maintaining the secrecy of UFOs. That kind of has emerged later with historical documents being released. So at the time, I think it makes a lot of sense to basically identify Alan Dulles as being part of that group of people, whether he was personally involved, because there were other people like Richard Helms, who were also part of the covert operations of the CIA at the time, that they also may have been kind of recruited into this operation to first discredit and then to remove James Forrestal.
And why was Forrestal denied? I mean, we can speculate here, and I think our speculation would probably be right at this point. Why was Forrestal denied visitations from his family and even two priests?
Exactly right. Yes. So Forrestal, soon after he was sacked by Truman in March of 47, he was committed to the Bethesda Medical Facility, and he was basically held there incarcerated. And what's very interesting, people who have written about Forrestal, biographers and so forth, comment on this period as being very, very significant, because essentially what was happening was that Forrestal was receiving a lot of visitors. A lot of people were coming to see him, including Truman himself, coming to see him, but yet Forrestal was denied visitation rights, people that Forrestal wanted to see, there were his brother Henry, two priests, and also a personal friend. These were four people that James Forrestal repeatedly asked to see, but he was denied access to them. But while he's being denied access to them, all of these other powerful people from the establishment are visiting Forrestal. So I think it's and one of those people, very interestingly, was Lyndon Johnson.
Yeah.
So Johnson comes into the picture. So I think what is emerging here was that there was a very powerful effort being placed on Forrestal to basically do something, agree to something, which I think explains why it was that he was not allowed visitation, but yet all of these other people from the National Security Establishment were allowed access to him. And interestingly enough...
he didn't care much about Johnson either.
He didn't. He hated Johnson. He thought Johnson was someone that just kind of like was just really out to aggrandize himself. But yet Johnson was given visitation rights. And another interesting person that was given visitation rights was Admiral Suers. And for those that have studied the MJ-12 documents, they'll notice that Admiral Sidney Suers was one of the principal people on MJ-12. Actually, one of the first people, along with Forrestal, on MJ-12. So Forrestal and Sidney Suers were part of the founding group of MJ-12. And so, of course, you've got Truman visiting, you've got Sidney Suers visiting, and then you have Lyndon Johnson visiting. All of these people connected with MJ-12, and I think what was happening was that they were trying to get Forrestal to agree not to go down the path of disclosing, because I don't think that they really wanted to eliminate Forrestal. I think that they were really trying to pressure him to stop doing what he was doing. But I think Forrestal truly was a visionary, a very idealistic man that believed that the world had a right to know this information. And I think he just didn't relent. I think that they put a lot of pressure on him to kind of forego his effort to let the American public know the truth. And when they failed, and when it became clear that he wasn't going to relent, and when Henry Forrestal, that's James Forrestal's brother, succeeded in being able to put pressure on the hospital to give him access.
He sued the hospital.
Exactly. He threatened to sue the hospital. He threatened to go public that the hospital is denying him access to his brother, to see his brother. And so eventually the hospital relented and gave James Forrestal's brother Henry access. Henry saw Forrestal four times in that last period just before his death, and had arranged for James Forrestal to be released to his custody. So the morning of the very day that Forrestal was to be released into the custody of his brother Henry, and Henry Forrestal said James was looking forward to being released and basically resuming life, then we have this supposed suicide where James Forrestal was supposed to have jumped from the 16th floor from the Bethesda Naval Facility to his death.
Which I find very interesting, because the day he allegedly committed suicide, a priest was finally able to arrive at the hospital, but they didn't allow the priest. Could it be because Catholic confession might risk disclosing sensitive national security information?
I think that makes a lot of sense. I mean, if you look at what is it about denying priests the access to a patient who's supposedly suffering psychiatric problems. I mean, if you look at all of the medical manuals on psychiatry, religious people are primarily some of those that can help patients recover from serious illnesses, and of course the Catholic confession, where the priest receives whatever information that the patient has that is troubling them, is actually has a lot of therapeutic value. So for the Catholic priests to be denied access was kind of like contrary to the prevailing opinion on psychiatry, and so during the whole time that Forrestal was committed, or was basically held at Bethesda Medical Facility, priest was never given access to him. And I think, well, if you look at why wasn't a priest given access, I think the logical answer is that, well, Forrestal would likely have shared national security information that was something that the national security establishment didn't want to get out, and that Forrestal could do this during the Catholic confessional without there really being any kind of real consequences for him. So I think that's why they denied the two priests access to Forrestal.
And the day that he died, a priest showed up, correct me if I'm wrong, but with all the commotion, didn't a hospital employee approach the priest and said, Mr. Forrestal did not commit suicide. Didn't that happen too?
Yes, exactly. There was a Marine, a warrant officer, I believe the rank was, who basically walked up to the priest. You know, there was a lot of commotion. Walked up to the priest, a very kind of senior-looking guy, very, very like in his late 30s, 40s, so someone who definitely looked like he had a lot of experience, and he just said to the priest that James Forrestal did not kill himself. This was not a suicide. And then he just, you know, people were all around and they were kind of listening, and so he just kind of looked around and he left. But the priest kind of relayed on that information that, yes, someone who worked at the hospital with a lot of experience was basically giving him the information that this was not a suicide, that this had been a murder.
And I'm just looking at it from a devil's advocate perspective. I hate doing this, but I'm trying to look from the other side, you know, as per the why. And this seems to be a case of loose lips sink ships. And after World War II, you know, we have this technology, we have this knowledge, we have MJ-12 investigating Roswell, and Forrestal wanted to talk, wanted to tell the world. Could it be that all these people were concerned because others, you know, the Soviets, would actually learn the technology and use it against us?
I think you're right, Mel. There's a lot of arguments that can be used to basically say that, you know, Forrestal had no right to go out and basically start giving unauthorized briefings to people on very sensitive national security issues at a time when America's future lay, it wasn't quite clear what was going to be happening. Of course, the Soviet Union was developing their own stockpile of atomic weapons and so forth. So it was a very dangerous time. So why release sensitive national security information that the enemies of the United States, such as the Soviet Union, could possibly use against them? So certainly that's a valid argument to make. But what I will say in Forrestal's defense is that he was the man on the ground. I mean, he knew all the facts. You know, you, I, you know, we're going on kind of a very limited data pool. You know, we're going on the limited information we've been able to receive from, you know, leaked classified documents or FOIA information or whistleblowers or contactee experiences. So we kind of have, you know, a part of the picture. And, you know, I think it's, you know, it's as good as it can be. But I think the important thing was that Forrestal had the whole picture. He had the whole picture of what was going on, and I think his background and his kind of commitment to doing the right thing, and I think it's, what's important here is that Forrestal was very much an egalitarian. He was not comfortable with the kind of elitist culture of the Protestant establishment. And he saw the secrecy surrounding UFOs and the extraterrestrial technologies as really being something that this kind of elite establishment would take advantage of and basically aggrandize themselves, not share this information with the common man, and basically create what we now know today to be like a technologically segregated society where we live, as you well know, according to Richard Dolan, you know, we have a breakaway society and we have kind of the white world or the open world where we have iPads, iPhones and all of that, and we think that's fantastic. But that's kind of like just a shadow of what this breakaway society possesses. And I think Forrestal was very prescient. He recognised that this elite Protestant establishment, that that's exactly where they were going. That's what they wanted to do. And he was opposed. He didn't agree with it. He knew what they planned to do. And I think history has proved Forrestal right, that not only was he an idealistic man who really wanted to share what was really happening with the world, but he also recognized that there was an elite establishment culture operating here that was going to take advantage of these technologies, keep it to themselves, not share it with the rest of the public, and basically use it as a means to lord themselves over the rest of society. And that, I think, is exactly what has happened.
Definitely. And Henry Forrestal, Forrestal's brother, he was supposed to show up, and just hours before he was supposed to show up and take custody of his brother, he commits, quote-unquote, commit suicide. For some reason, I read something that somebody, a journalist or somebody related to Forrestal, had given an interview.
Yes. One of the biographers was there able to interview. One of the biographers who was doing research on James Forrestal was able to interview Henry Forrestal.
What did he say?
Henry Forrestal said that this was clearly a case of murder, that James Forrestal was in good health. He was of sound mind. He was looking forward to his release. He was looking forward to a very productive life after his stint as Secretary of Defense. So Henry Forrestal was convinced that this was murder, because he had spoken with James just before his release, just before he was supposed to be released. He was, you know, finally given access and visited him four times. So he was the man who was best able to kind of give any insight into James Forrestal's mindset. And he was saying James was really ready to be released and he was looking forward to it. And so Henry Forrestal was convinced that it was murder.
And I look again at Lyndon B. Johnson, and for some reason, I think also of George H.W. Bush, who probably has nothing to do with this story. But it's interesting how these people had something to do with Kennedy. We could speculate about Bush's involvement with the assassination. We could speculate the same about Lyndon Johnson, but they both became vice presidents. You know, doesn't that make you suspicious that all of a sudden this man, Lyndon B. Johnson, goes see Forrestal and then eventually becomes Kennedy's running mate when he actually wanted somebody else? There was, I forgot the actual name, but there was somebody else with a similar background to Kennedy who he wanted to be vice president, right?
That's right, yes. That's Stuart Symington, who was the first Secretary of the Air Force.
Is he Fife Symington's father, or was he?
Ah, that's an interesting connection, you know. It may be. I just don't know. But that may be an interesting connection, yes. It could be.
Anyway, go ahead with what you were saying.
So Stuart Symington was someone that John F. Kennedy wanted him to run as his vice president, but he realized that in order to be successful, to win the Democratic nomination, he needed to have the support of the southern states. And so he thought the key to getting the support of the southern states was to get Lyndon Johnson on board. And so he kind of, in a perfunctory way, if you like, offered Johnson the vice presidential running slot, you know, thinking that, well, there's no way he would accept. Why, you know, the leading senator at the time, you know, the ranking senator in the Senate, why would he accept this position to be the running mate of a junior senator? But he did, and that kind of shocked Kennedy. But I think the interesting thing about Johnson was, and I think that's what you mentioned earlier or alluded to earlier, was that he had earlier had an association with this kind of covert group, that, you know, related to the CIA, as did George Herbert Walker Bush. And with in the case of Lyndon B. Johnson, Johnson was connected to the MJ-12 group. And we know that Johnson was being briefed along with Kennedy about very sensitive national security information, including UFOs, but that Johnson was part of this group of people that were leaning on James Forrestal when he was in the hospital, that Johnson went along to kind of add his two cents into whatever it was that they wanted to get Forrestal to agree to. But what that visit shows to me, or demonstrates to me, is that because Johnson was an uninvited guest, he was there to basically read the Riot Act, or to really put pressure on Forrestal to accept something that Forrestal was not willing to. And that, to me, suggests that Johnson was very early on part of the MJ-12 operations, that he had become an asset. He had become recruited by MJ-12. In a way, it's almost like, I think the way to see this is that it's interesting that Johnson and Kennedy were both the two congressmen who were being given briefings by senior officials, including Forrestal and other senior officials in the national security establishment. And in a sense, it's almost like Kennedy and Johnson kind of represented two factions within MJ-12. One faction, we might call it the faction wanting openness and disclosure, was headed by Forrestal. You know, Kennedy was their man. And the other faction, which wanted secrecy, was tied in with this group that were, you know, that was associated with Alan Dulles and the covert operations, assassination, and so forth, was allied with Johnson. Johnson was allied with that faction. So it's almost like you have these two congressmen, Johnson and Kennedy, whose fates intersected in that critical period after the Second World War, when all of the UFO extraterrestrial information was being released. And it was almost like they were fated to go different paths, even though they were given a choice.
And I think of, again, going back to Johnson and the similarities between he and George Herbert Walker Bush, you say that he was a senior senator. Why would he accept to be the running mate unless he had his sights on the presidency, and perhaps he would take over prematurely, as he did? The same thing with Bush 41. I don't think Reagan really wanted him as the running mate. I think he was coerced to have him as the running mate because he did not, he was not selected to be the candidate. But what happened just not even 2 months after Reagan was took office, you know, Reagan almost died. Bush knew that was the only way that he could become president. So, you know, these two people, as you say, they're from one faction and the other. But we have to take a one and only intermission. But when we come back, I want to discuss where Eisenhower was. Was he one who wanted transparency and disclosure? Or was he on the dark side trying to keep things hidden? I'm a little bit unclear of this because I think even though he had that speech, his farewell speech stating that beware of the military-industrial complex, wasn't he part of it? Wasn't he one of the engineers of creating the entire military industrial congressional complex Hydra, but we'll get your answer on the other side. Michael, how can people buy this new excellent book?
They can go onto Amazon.com and they can find it there, Kennedy's Last Stand, or they can go to my website, exopolitics.org, and they can find the links there to read some of the material and to go ahead and get the book.
Okay, everybody, that was Dr. Michael Sala. His research is impeccable. And you don't get to hear that story anywhere else, do you? That is showing the threads, the links between MJ-12 and President Kennedy and how the breakaway society started. Now what I'd like to do is go and share with you Grant Cameron's research. And this is fast forwarding to Bill Clinton. When we left off with President Kennedy, we went through Lyndon Johnson, Richard Nixon, Gerald Ford, Jimmy Carter, Ronald Reagan, George H.W. Bush, and now Bill Clinton. So the conversation comes back up about disclosure with President Clinton. So let's enjoy this from Grant Cameron. This is the Citizens Hearing on Disclosure, April 29th.
My name is Grant Cameron. I am a private investigator. For the past 38 years, I have attempted to focus on what the highest levels of the U.S. government, military, and intelligence agencies know about the UFO phenomenon. I'm the director of the President's UFO website. As Steve Bassett mentioned, the Obama administration has come up with official statements saying there is no ET evidence for an interaction with ETs, and there is no cover-up. What I would like to do based on my years of research is present a few pieces of evidence which show that this statement written by a low-level White House staffer is ill-informed and not true. Mr. Dolan pointed out that President Truman had been briefed for 5 years orally on the subject of UFOs. That does not appear in the official record. I'd like to add that Truman on video does make a statement stating, yes, we discussed it at every conference we had with the military. There were always things like that going on, flying saucers and other such things. In 1969, the U.S. government officially shut down its official UFO investigation, stating that there was no evidence that UFOs were extraterrestrial and therefore they were out of the business. If this were true, the government would have shut up and allowed the subject to fade into history. This is not, however, what happened. Only 3 years after shutting down their program, the U.S. Air Force, at the direction of the Secretary of the Air Force, contacted two documentary film producers who signed an official film contract at the Pentagon to do a documentary on UFOs. They were provided with a number of films and pictures, including a film of extraterrestrials landing at Holloman Air Force Base, of which they used 8 seconds in the final production. They were given another film marked Top Secret that was never returned and is still in their possession. The documentary was funded with $250,000, and they were asked not to source the funder of the money in the credits. A CIA agent was present through the entire production, and as Linda Howe can testify, she saw a letter to one of the producers from President Richard Nixon thanking him for his cooperation on the project. Former Senator Barry Goldwater wrote extensively on UFOs, such as in 1975 when he wrote about his friend General Curtis LeMay, who refused him access in 1964 to the Blue Room at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, where alien hardware and bodies were rumored to have been held. Goldwater wrote, "I made an effort to find out what was in that building at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and I was understandably denied this request. It is still classified above top secret." As chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, Goldwater continued to answer UFO letters, stating in one letter, "This thing has gotten so highly classified, it is impossible to get anything on it." In another letter, Goldwater wrote, "I have no idea who controls the flow of need to know, because frankly, I was told in such an emphatic way that it was none of my business that I've never tried to make it my business since." And finally, Goldwater wrote, "I have been interested in this subject for a long time, and I know that whatever the Air Force has on the subject is going to remain highly classified." Those waiting for the president to stand up and say ETs are here should know that that event occurred on June the 27th, 1981. Steven Spielberg stated that after the screening of ET, the extraterrestrial, in the White House theater, Reagan, quote, "just stood up and looked around the room, almost like he was doing a head count. And he said, I want to thank you for bringing ET to the White House. We really enjoyed your movie. And then he looked around the room and he said, and there are a number of people in this room who know that everything on that screen is absolutely true. And Spielberg added, and he said it without smiling. If you check the files of the Bush Library, you'll find nothing on UFOs. However, if you look at my files, you will find an audio of President Bush during the 1988 campaign being asked about UFOs, in which he says, I know some. I know a fair bit. Likewise, I have a video of Vice President Dan Quayle stating, the alien situation is very interesting. We literally spent some time looking at this. In April 2001, I asked Vice President Dick Cheney if he had been ever briefed on the subject of UFOs while he was on the Diana Reem show here in Washington. Instead of Cheney stating that there were no credible ET evidence, Cheney replied, if I had been briefed on that subject, it would probably be classified and I wouldn't be talking about it. Even President Obama has said things that run contrary to the statement put out by his own White House. This might be because neither he nor anybody in his office saw the petition on the ET question put in by Steve Bassett, despite the fact that over 12,000 people signed the petition addressed to the president. During a visit to Roswell, New Mexico in 2012, President Obama referred to the White House, to the Roswell crash, saying, "We're going to keep our secrets here." This raises the question, in light of the statement put out by his office that there is no ET cover-up, what secrets is President Obama referring to? Then, during a White House tour, President Obama anticipated a question that actor Will Smith's son, Jaden, wanted to ask about the reality of extraterrestrials. When they arrived in the White House Situation Room, the president said to Jaden, "I know what you want to ask. You want to know about the aliens. I can neither confirm nor deny that extraterrestrials have visited the Earth. But if they had, and if there had been a top secret meeting on the subject, it would have occurred in this very room." Then there is the story of Area 51, covered by 19-time Emmy Award-winning investigative reporter George Knapp, who has spent years covering the story. Knapp stated that he has over 24 witnesses who tell bits and pieces of a story of a captured live alien and extraterrestrial spacecrafts that are being back-engineered on the Nevada test site. He has also revealed during interviews that he had a discussion with Senator Howard Cannon shortly before his death, and that Howard Cannon basically confirmed to him that he had talked to Goldwater and the stories were true. Knapp stated that six of his witnesses were threatened, which succeeded them from stopping them from going on camera. Finally, in July 2012, Chase Brandon, a 42-year veteran of the CIA, was a guest of the 2 million listeners of the overnight radio talk show called Coast to Coast. His words on the ET cover-up were clear as he referenced material he had seen at CIA headquarters. To quote Chase Brandon, "I absolutely know, as I sit here talking to you, that there was a craft beyond this world that crashed at Roswell, and that the military picked up the remains of not just a wreckage, but of cadavers. 100% in my heart and soul, said Brandon, Roswell happened. There was a craft and absolutely cadavers. I don't know where the stuff is, but I know that Roswell happened. Thank you.
Okay, so now what I'd like to share with you is a 2005 President Clinton making a speech in Hong Kong, talks about looking into Roswell, UFOs, and Area 51. And this video was uncovered by Grant Cameron in his work on the presidents and the UFOs. We know that President Clinton was set up by Lawrence Rockefeller to be the disclosure president, and this is all we have on tape that he ever said about it. Here we go.
I've always wanted to ask this question, and I'm going to use my position to ask it quickly. When I was at your library, that's not that bad, don't worry.
Okay, all right.
When I was at your library opening, I was standing in your replica office, Oval Office. It's an incredibly powerful feeling. I've never been to the White House. I'm not a Republican, but I looked at your desk, and I was wondering from president to president whether you pass a list along of secrets that only you and a couple of President Bush Sr., President Bush, Jimmy Carter, Gerald Ford, now like, where's Jimmy Hoffa, or what really happened at Roswell. So without giving away any state secrets, is there something we can all look forward to in the future to read about that you know that we don't know that will really make the National Enquirer required reading?
I don't know if you all remember this, but there was actually, when I was president in my second term, there was an anniversary observance of Roswell. Do you remember that? People came to Roswell, New Mexico from all over the world. And there's also a site in Nevada where people were convinced that the government had buried a UFO and perhaps an alien deep underground because we wouldn't allow anybody to go there. And I can say now, because it's now been released into the public domain, I had so many people in my own administration were convinced that Roswell was a fraud, but this place in Nevada was really serious. There was an alien artifact there. So I actually sent somebody there to figure it out. And it was actually just a secret defense installation, alas, and doing boring work that we just didn't want anybody else to see. So I can't think of that. I give you a serious thing, though. I spent a lot of, in 2000, I was able to participate with Tony Blair and representatives of the French, German, Japanese, and Canadian governments in announcing that we had succeeded in sequencing the human genome. And perhaps some of you have investments in all these biotech companies, and now you know we cloned Dolly the sheep, and now apparently they may have cloned a dog, and we're all talking about this. My own view is that assuming we don't do something stupid like burn ourselves up with global warming or blow ourselves up with a military conflict we could just as easily avoid, I think a lot of these biotechnology issues will be the dominant sort of intellectual and ethical challenges of the lives of those of you who are 10, 20, 30 years younger than I am. Because I think that we are going to be able to save people's lives that, you know, in my generation couldn't be saved. And we are going to come up against the limits of our own mortality in a way we never could before. And a lot of the things that happen, good and bad, will be stranger than anything ever written in science fiction. But I don't know the answers, which is one reason I would like to live to be 100, just to see what happens.
So that means there's a list or no list?
What? What'd you say?
I was just joking. The list,
you should have said, I don't know what you said, but you should have said there's absolutely no risk of that. Given my misspent youth, I'm lucky to be here now.
What I didn't say was that there really is no list, or there is a list, the secrets.
If there is one, I don't know it. I mean, I really, the Roswell thing, I think, really was an illusion. I don't think it happened. I mean, I think there are rational explanations that I have succeeded, and I did attempt to find out if there were any secret government documents that reveal things. And if there were, they were concealed from me too. I wouldn't be the first president that underlings have lied to or that career bureaucrats have waited out. But there may be some career person sitting around somewhere hiding these dark secrets, even from elected presidents. But if so, they successfully eluded me. And I'm almost embarrassed to tell you I did try to find out.
Well, that
okay, we're going to run out of time very quickly here. I want to finish up with a statement from Stephen Bassett from the Citizens Hearing on Disclosure. We're looking now at President Obama being the disclosure president, and I'll be writing up an article called Full Galactic Disclosure that goes through and documents everything I've been trying to show through these videos today. And thank you for sharing this and being a witness.
I've asked what is perhaps the seminal question of our time, this time. How do we regain control? How do the citizens of the country regain control? And I would like to make a modest proposal. We went through an extraordinary period called the Cold War. Nothing like it ever before. We built 86,000 nuclear weapons, six or seven countries. Four or five times we nearly launched them. It would have ended all of civilization, which would have been a killer on a resume, if you know what I mean. We basically gave the government license to do whatever it had to do to protect us and make that not happen. And we built a vast secret, what I call empire. Other countries did as well. The Cold War was over and we won it. What we're supposed to do then was to, how would you say, reform, dismantle, readjust back to something more appropriate. We didn't do that. We kept right on going. And now this thing is out of control. It's like the guys that the town hires to come in and clean out the bad guys. And then when the bad guys are gone, it turns out the guys they hired may have been a problem. How are you going to get back control of a complex this vast that's funded by trillions of dollars? It's going to take a key, really, really big, a really big key. And I think there's only one that has a chance. And that's why this is called the Citizen Hearing on Disclosure. We have a vast interest in the subject and a huge attention by the world. The government's in a position where I think we have them in checkmate. If they are put in a position where they have to disclose that there is an extraterrestrial presence, we couldn't tell you before now, we're telling you today, I believe it will trigger the greatest age of institutional reform the world has ever seen, in which billions of people focusing their eyes in the same direction are going to try to adjust, reform every aspect of human society and try to get it back to where it should be. And that will make an amazing amount of wonderful television coverage. Looking forward to it. The age of reform, I think, is just on the other side of disclosure. We have to get through that door. That is how we get control back.
Thank you.
The congressional hearings on disclosure is how we get control back, and that's where we're headed next. And that's what I wanted to share with you today, so that when people ask you, why is disclosure so important, then you see the thread and you understand the history and you know what's going on. So thank you for being here with me tonight. We're going to play it out now. And I will write this up so you can share it with others. Thank you, everybody. Please visit me next Wednesday night. And don't forget, I'm on Bob Charles' show in the morning, 10 a.m. Eastern. Look it up at WBAD.com. That's Washington, D.C. Internet Radio. Good night, everybody.